Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Fake TV Critic, a podcast where I discuss the week's biggest TV news headlines, recap and analyze some of my favorite shows, and let you know what you should be watching. Strike is over. Finally. I'm in a goofy mood today. It's 9:30 in the morning on a Sunday, and I'm feeling myself, so buckle up. Strike is over. We have been waiting months and months and months and months, and it is finally over. The SAG, AFTRA, and the AMPTP reached a deal on Wednesday night, and it was approved on Thursday, and the membership is voting on it this week, but the strike is over, and yay, because people were out of work, and shit is dire in terms of entertainment. The biggest boon of this strike ending should hopefully be that the films opening now and soon and award season coming up, that all of that should be, we can now get like press season, which you don't tend to think of like being a big deal. I don't know. There was a lot of hoopla made. There's a lot of hoopla made about the fact that like actors couldn't talk about the work that was in the can. So for the past 120-ish days, movies, TV shows, things that have been created and are being released into the world are being released without any promotion from the people who are in those things. And I would have assumed this wasn't all that big of a deal. I mean, I don't know. I don't watch like the Today Show or I don't know, the Kelly Clarkson show or Entertainment Tonight or whatever the hell. Like I would have assumed that this wouldn't be that big of a deal, that like the cast can't do interviews and stuff like that. But apparently it's really been hurting a lot of smaller things or a lot of things that could, I guess, benefit from the visibility of the stars that are in things. Like, I'm thinking in particular, like, Apple TV right now has Lessons in Chemistry that either is still airing or just finished, and it's based on a best-selling book, so that's good. It has some name recognition, but it's starring Brie Larson, who not only has an Oscar, but is also would have been doing the press circuit for The Marvels, which just opened this weekend. So the movie, or the strike ended just in time for Brie Larson and the rest of the cast to start doing some promo, but whereas it might have benefited from that because it's, I don't know, not that it's lesser known because everyone knows that she's Captain Marvel if you're interested in these movies. But like maybe kind of tying together like how do these three characters of the Marvels fit together? And then she could have, you know, slipped in the promotion of Lessons in Chemistry and there could have been some cross promotion of like, hey, do you love these Marvel movies? Do you like Brie Larson? Because she's in this Apple TV show. And I don't, again, going back, I don't think that that seems like that big of a deal. I'm not the kind of person who is only ever aware of something because, like, there's an article on Entertainment Weekly or because I see them promoting it at 7:30 while I'm waiting for my 8 o'clock show to start and, it, you know, whatever the fuck is on Entertainment Tonight or All Access Hollywood or whatever the hell those shows are. I don't tend to think those things are necessary, but apparently they are. And I think it's especially going to start being helpful now when we have like these smaller indie films or, you know, like not the tentpole blockbusters. Like as much as The Marvels is crashing and burning apparently in theaters right now, you can't blame that on Brie Larson not being able to promote it. You know what I mean? It's The Marvels. It's a fucking Marvel movie. People should be aware of what it is. And you can pump tons and tons and tons of money into production, and that's how you make people aware of it, is you air commercials and advertisements and digital banners and that kind of shit. So there is a bigger conversation of like, how do we promote and advertise things? But regardless, now with, you know, could Killers of the Flower Moon, for example, maybe have benefited from Leonardo DiCaprio going out and doing press? Probably. Because then the common narrative around that movie became the backlash from the indigenous populations who disapproved of the movie because they weren't under contract and they're not members of the SAG union. So that became the dominant narrative of Killers of the Flower Moon being in theaters. would it have been helpful for Leonardo DiCaprio or Lily Gladstone to counter that narrative? Yes, absolutely. But they couldn't until now, and it's already out of a lot of theaters. So maybe there'll be some re-release or something around Christmas or around the ramp up to Oscar nominations. But all of that to say that, again, the strike is over. You will start seeing celebrities again. They can start talking about shit again. I'm just glad that maybe there will finally be some, like, stuff happening again, like some news that I can actually, you know, talk about, or new TV eventually that I can watch and discuss, because some slim pickings. So strike was over as of last Wednesday, and stuff is getting right back into production. Since the writer's strike ended a few weeks ago, there are scripts being written and being prepared, and apparently there are shows that are already starting production again this week. So on the 15th, which is this Wednesday? Yeah, this Wednesday, NBC's Night Court revival goes back into production for season 2. That will be the first show back in production post-strike. And then the week after Thanksgiving, which is coming up so soon, so wild, is going to be most of the rest of the broadcast network slate, shows on ABC and CBS, you know, like Grey's Anatomy, all the FBI and Law and Order shows, Blue Bloods, all those things, plus Pretty Little Liars, the new version on HBO Max, which, or not HBO Max, on Max, which was almost done filming when the strike had occurred. That's going back into production. Apples Never Fall, which is on Peacock. It's based on a Leanne Moriarty, who wrote Big Little Lies book, and also Nine Perfect Strangers. And that was in the middle of production. And Chucky, which has, I think, maybe two more episodes or one more episode left to film. Those are all going back into production the week after Thanksgiving. And then by early December, everything else that was shut down while they were in production is going to be coming back as well. And then in the new year are when things that were kind of just starting out or just ramping up are going to get back into production, like Emily in Paris and Lincoln Lawyer and that kind of stuff. So yay. And with this news, there was like a flurry of other stuff that was kind of happening around it. Like ABC finally made a decision on canceling the Rookie spinoff Feds. They're not going forward with their Good Lawyer pilot, which was a spinoff of The Good Doctor. What else? They're firming up like commitments for numbers of episodes. Shows are going to be producing between 10 and 13 episodes for next season, and that they could start airing as soon as like January, February, depending on when they go into production. So yay, here we are, yay. So that's great. Let's mishmash some shit this week, because here we are. There's nothing. I'm watching Bravo and Hallmark, and that's like it. So to follow up on last week's episode about fellow travelers, I will say, I watched episode 2, and there is a butt. Matt Bomer shows his butt in episode 2. So if you are interested in that, go ahead and it's in the first, I think, like 5 minutes. So go ahead and just like turn that on for the 5 minutes, see the butt, and then you can dip out. Or it's a really good show so far. Like I said, I watched the first 2 episodes, and it's very it's very well done. It's not always the most entertaining. I don't know if it's supposed to be, but it is a very well done series. The acting is wonderful. It goes, and we get to see Matt's rear. So go ahead and check that out. What else? Survivor had a really big episode this week, kind of following up on my Survivor episode from a few weeks ago. I complained in that episode that we're seeing so much like meaningless shit in the new 90-minute format of the episodes, and we still kind of are, but now that they're finally merged, like I suspected was going to happen, some of the stuff that we'd seen that seemed like time killers or time wasters just to, you know, pad out the runtime, is starting to come back. Like there was this one random scene in episode like 1 or 2 where Dee, who was on the original Reba tribe, was like talking about how she has freakishly long toes and they're really good for like picking things up, like off the ground, like as if they're hands. And that seemed just like a really quirky, weird thing that they threw in because maybe Dee is gonna go far and this, you know, like fleshes her out as like a quirky, kind of weird, but kooky, funny character that we want to like later on. Like one of those things, you know, like when someone's on reality TV and they drop like little breadcrumbs. I'm thinking in particular about competition shows, especially like RuPaul's Drag Race is the one that immediately comes to mind. When they start peppering in the storylines, like when the queens are getting ready in the workroom with their makeup, with things about like, what was your coming out like? What's your relationship with your parents? Who's your drag mother? What, like, those little quirky things, like in season five, when they would just focus on Jinx and her narcolepsy and she would just be sleeping in a corner. Like weird, quirky things like that that get you on a person's side so that you want to root for them in the finale. So it seemed like one of those things that maybe Dee goes far. This is going back to the toes, sorry. That Dee goes far. So they want us to, they're showing us this like weird, quirky little characteristic that will make us like, it's a little thing that'll make us like her or think that she's, you know, fun. But instead, in this last episode, this past week, it came back because they were doing a challenge where you have to, you're on a, it's like a big pole, and you have to wrap yourself around it. And there's little tiny footholds that, like, it's un they're not enough to stand on, but like they're enough to just get like a little bit of a grip, right? And in past seasons, they were big enough to stand on. Like there was, I think it was Heroes versus Villains, maybe they did it. And I remember the image that a lot of people tweeted this week of Parvati, like an hour and a half into it, she was literally just like standing in one of the footholds. She wasn't bent around it or hugging the pole or anything. She was just fully standing up, hanging off the pole with one foot fully in one of the footholds. So they've now made them much smaller, so you can't do that. But Dee won the challenge. Like, she not only won immunity, but it was double immunity. And she was in one of two groups. And the winner over, like, the longest one, the winner overall, the last person in each group got immunity. But the last person in the whole group, in either group, they got to go to tribal second, meaning that the person and got reward. And going to tribal second meant that the person who got voted off in that group was on the jury, the person who got voted off in the first group, not on the jury. And then they like brought it all back that when she was up there like gripping the pole, she brought it back to her weird long toes. Like that was it was so silly. So I'm starting to get higher hopes that all the time that I thought was wasted toward the beginning of the series is going to start to come back to us as the series goes on. Although I have to also admit that I'm very upset. This tends to happen a lot recently with Survivor. I complained about it like maybe two or three seasons ago, when Shan was on, that the whole first half of that of her season focused on what a great game she was playing and how she was like clearly the winner so far. And then she ended up going home like halfway through the game. And then it became a scramble of like, okay, well, what the fuck do we focus the second half of the season on? And I don't remember. I literally don't remember who won that season. I have no idea. I only remember her. And I only remember her going home and me and a bunch of other viewers being like, what happens now? And I guess it's because like they had all this great footage of her playing the game and no one else really was. So what do you show? Do you just show people not being strategic, not looking for idols? No, you show the person doing that, but then you get screwed because then people realize she's a threat and they vote her out, and you're left with people who didn't do anything for the first like 10 episodes of the season. And that's kind of what I feel like is happening now because they voted off the quote unquote biggest threat, who is also the person we've been following most closely this season so far, and who was playing the most interesting and relatable both physical and social game, and that's Caleb. Like last week, he used his shot in the dark, which I'm still convinced this was fake and made up and for camera. The shot in the dark, if you're unfamiliar or haven't watched Survivor in a while, is a last-ditch effort that there is for every person at Tribal, there is a piece of paper. And out of however many people are there, one of those pieces of paper says that you are safe, and the rest say that you're not safe. So when you just randomly stick your hand into a bowl and pick out a piece of paper, and you do that instead of voting. So you sacrifice your vote and you get to play this shot in the dark. And then you give it to Jeff, and the paper either says safe or not safe. And if it says, if you get the one piece of paper in that bowl that says safe, then any vote cast against you does not count. If you get one that says not safe, you've given up your vote, and every vote cast against you counts. And historically, when people have used this, they've used it incorrectly, meaning that like they've played their shot in the dark when they were never actually in danger, and like they either had no votes or not enough votes for it to matter or whatever, and sometimes even screwed themselves over, like that their vote might have mattered in a different way. But there were, what, 12 people left, including Caleb, in this episode, and he played his shot in the dark. And it said safe. Now, I'm sorry, but you cannot convince me that out of 12 pieces of paper, he randomly, when he needed it most, picked the one that said safe. Because every single vote was for Caleb. Every single one was for Caleb. And normally I would say except for Caleb's, but remember, he doesn't vote. So every name in that bowl said Caleb. And I'm sorry, so that means that there were 10 votes because Caleb didn't vote and someone else sacrificed their vote to like make their immunity idol stronger or something. So you cannot tell me that that wasn't planned. And that was my whole feeling. So Caleb got to stay and someone else went home because he played a shot in the dark correctly. Now that to me is the producer setting up Caleb for a run to the finale, if not a win. No. Instead, we got all of that drama and then he went home the next episode. So unsatisfying. I'm sorry. Like having such a dramatic episode and then followed immediately by him just being voted off is terrible television. It just is. And so maybe I really wish that I could understand. This is both why Survivor is such an entertaining show because you really do never know what's going to happen and why it is so. Such a difficult show, I think, probably for editors and stuff like that, is because you don't know what's going to happen, like with the Shan season, you are stuck building a narrative around these stories that could just literally go nowhere, like Shan's did, like Caleb's now did, where you have these amazing moments, these water cooler moments that every show is looking for, especially now, when people like don't watch TV live, when TV viewership in general is just like cratering. To have these moments that make people talk, that are like, you have to watch this episode right now so that you can see what's happening. To have moments like that that require people to be sitting in front of their TVs and watching is so rare. And Survivor had one of those. And then a week later, it was utterly meaningless. It's fucking wild. And it's why I don't really like this new era, as Jeff likes to call it, of Survivor. Like, as entertaining, even though it pissed me off that shot in the dark was, to then have it just negated in the next episode is crazy. And then on top of that, there was the chance for Caleb not to go home, and there was one person who decided that they were going to vote against Caleb instead of play the game with Caleb. And I don't really understand her reasoning for it. So that's Survivor. What else have I been watching this week? Or what else have I caught up on? I'm still trying to get a guest to come on and talk about Real Housewives, so I don't know how much in depth I'll go. If I can't get them, I'll probably talk about like Beverly Hills, Miami, and Potomac soon. But Beverly Hills is back. I don't love it. BravoCon was last weekend, and they didn't really make any announcements except that one of them was that they ordered a two-episode spinoff for Erika Jayne, of all people, about her preparing for her Las Vegas quote-unquote residency, which is like 11 shows over 3 months, and it did so poorly that you could buy tickets on StubHub for literally $5. So that's coming, but also she's really annoying on this season of Beverly Hills, and I don't understand why they brought her back, let alone gave her her own fucking spinoff, but whatever. I don't run a network. But so Beverly Hills is back. I don't love it. I'm bored by it. Miami is back and I love it. Potomac is back and I love it. So hopefully I'll have someone on to talk about those soon. I'm teasing this as if like I know who it is. I don't. I reached out. I reached out, or I'm going to reach out to people that I think might be interested, or We'll see. But I haven't done anything. This is just me being lazy and like, I have this idea that I haven't actually followed through on. Anyway, what else? Oh, the Santa Clauses season two premiered this week, and I watched both new episodes. If you remember last year, I covered them in one of, in I think my November or my November, my Thanksgiving week episode, alongside A Christmas Story Christmas. Because the Santa Claus movie, the first one, is probably my favorite Christmas movie of all time. I pause because I have to think about that. Okay, so I was born in the 80s, so the late 80s, sorry. Sorry to my Gen X friends, but you're older than me. I was born in the late 80s, so I grew up watching, Home Alone, The Santa Claus, Jingle All the Way. Those are probably like my big top, and Home Alone 2, obviously. Those are like my big top Christmas movies. And then also, Christmas Vacation, obviously. But then I'm like weirdly of the generation where I saw Elf when it first came out in theaters, like in high school with like a bunch of my friends. So to me, that will never have the like quote unquote classic Christmas movie feeling to it because I saw it like as a teenager in theaters. Does that make sense? That I don't know, like it's definitely part of my tradition. I watch it every year and or well, not every year, but at least parts of it when it's on TV, I'll put it on in the background. And I like it, but it's too recent. Because how old was I when that movie came out? 15, 16, something like that. I was like 15 or 16 or about to be 16. And I'm sorry, but no 16-year-old, like nothing that happened to me when I was 16 is going to be considered like a nostalgic thing for me. Like that's a what things that happened to me at 16, I block out. Do you know? Does that make sense? The gays that are listening to this, it makes sense to you. You get what I'm saying. So like the thing, the 90s, what I'm getting at is the 90s stuff is what I think of as like my nostalgic Christmas. So again, Home Alone 1 and 2, Jingle All the Way, The Santa Claus, to a lesser extent, Christmas Vacation, because that was already here and gone. But then also like the Nickelodeon Christmas specials, that kind of stuff. That is my Christmas. But The Santa Claus maybe is like at the top of that list as my favorite. It's Home Alone. When I was a kid, I used to literally watch on repeat. We had 1 and 2 on VHS. And I would pick a day and just like at breakfast, pop that VHS in, and then all day, literally, and when I say all day, I literally mean all day, like 9 a.m. until dinner. So like 5 or 6. Just watch the movie, rewind it, watch it again, rewind it, watch it again. And I'm not joking. That was what we did. And it was one day it would be Home Alone, the next day Home Alone 2, the next day the Santa Claus, the next day Jingle All the Way. And that was like what I did, especially if I was sick, fucking forget it. If I was sick and I was home from school, it would be anything to make me feel better. And usually the one that I chose if I was sick was the Santa Claus. All of this to say that the original Santa Claus holds such a special place in my heart. And then, like, nothing else in the Santa Claus franchise after has really come close. Santa Claus 2 is bad, but not the worst. Santa Claus 3 is very bad, but until this series came along, not the worst. The first season of this series is the worst. It is terrible. And the second season is like a little bit of an improvement so far, but I don't think that the people who make the Santa Claus movies and TV show understand what made the first one so good. And if I probably already said this last year, but deal with it. Sorry, I'm gonna repeat myself. That like what made the Santa Claus so great was its groundedness. The whole first like half hour of that movie is Tim Allen playing a regular dude, a regular dad who is fucking up Christmas, who is too committed to his work to care about his kid, burns the turkey, and then finally he gets this thing to connect with his son, which is becoming literal Santa Claus, and like the hijinks of a regular man doing the Santa Claus things and then winding up in this magical fantasy world of the North Pole. But what was great, but what made it so good was that first half hour where it was grounded in the real world. Like that is the best part of the whole movie, and you won't convince me otherwise. That first half is the funniest part because of its sarcasm. It is the most entertaining part because of the mashup of the real and the fantastical. Is that a word? Fantastical? Fantastic? Phantasmagoric? Loopy. Toto's in a weird mood. Anyway, that is what made that first movie so entertaining. And then, you know, that as Tim Allen, Scott Calvin become Santa in the second half of the movie in the next Christmas, where he like has to live in the real world as he gains all this weight and grows a beard and his hair turns white, and the giant freaking Naughty and Nice List shows up at his house. Like, all of that is what made that movie funny and relatable and good, basically. So for the second and third movie and now the show, setting it at the North Pole does not ground it in reality, it grounds it in fantasy. So instead we're getting a fantasy movie with some real world stuff sprinkled in, rather than a real world drama with some fantasy stuff sprinkled in. Does that make sense? So that's what made the first movie good, and that's also what, like, I think takes away from these other movies, is like, and the second movie had the best balance because it was Scott Calvin needing to go back into the real world and find a Mrs. Claus. So it was kind of more evenly split between reality and fantasy. The third, pure fantasy. I don't know if there was like a handful of scenes that took place in the real world. Same thing with the first season of this show. And now the second season is that it's when you're setting it amongst these like magical creatures and like your supporting cast is all elves instead of real people, or, you know, as in, I guess it was the third Santa Claus movie where you're bringing in all these other mythical creatures like the Tooth Fairy and Cupid and Father Time and Mother Nature and all that stuff. That like when your main supporting cast isn't people, it's these, you know, fantasy characters. It's flipping the script literally from what made the first one so good. And I think the second season is going to try to course correct a little bit, because the head elf Betty, who took over for Bernard in season one of the show, is going on what they call a cribble crabble, which is when every elf needs to go experience the human world. And even two episodes in, we haven't seen her go there yet, but she's left. We just haven't seen her in the real world. So I'm kind of hoping that storyline will give us that, like, the grounded in reality thing. I just hope they don't do a remake of Elf, speaking of, where an elf goes into the real world and has no idea how humans act. But the actual storyline this season is not interesting. It's more of the same. It's literally the same story as the first season. So if you remember, the first season was about another Santa Claus with an E, where as Santa picks his successor, he gets to retire. So it's about Scott looking for someone to succeed him as Santa Claus. And that was what the first season was too, when he picked Cal Penn's character, who was the tech guy basically that ran like an Amazon type service, who just completely AI robot commercialized Christmas and ruined Christmas spirit for everyone. So they restored it at the end of the season by giving everyone in the world who believed in Santa a snow globe with their best Christmas memory inside. So it picks up right from there, and now it's a year later, and Scott has decided randomly that his teenage son, who is a doofus, is going to be the next Santa for no reason. Another fatal flaw of the show is that anyone who's watched any of the Santa Claus movies knows that the natural choice to succeed Scott is Charlie, the kid from the very first movie and the second movie, and we see as like a teenage delinquent in the third. He was in an episode last season, the first season of the show, and basically was like, no, I have a family now. I don't want to be Santa anymore. And whereas that could have been like a really great kind of reconciliation story for Scott and Charlie, because if you remember, the whole first movie is about how Charlie leans into and loves the Santa side of things so much and Scott doesn't. But that's what connects them. So it's through Charlie's excitement of the whole process that Scott really embraces being Santa. And this would have been a really great opportunity to flip that, where Scott becomes the Charlie character who brings his son the magic of Christmas so that Charlie can take over. I don't know why they did not think of it. I'm sure they did. And maybe Eric Lloyd, who played Charlie, didn't want to do it or whatever, or they wanted it to be younger and goofier. I don't know. But But he picks his dumbass teenage son, Cal, to succeed him. And that's about as far as we get. Now, there's also a plot line of Magnus Antis, played by Eric Stonestreet from Modern Family, playing like a historic Santa called the Mad Santa, who was like crazy and mean. And at the end of in the finale of the last season, we had Scott meeting all the successive Santa Clauses in history, like Saint Nick and Mag, and there was one missing, and it was Magnus Antis, the Mad Santa. And now we're going to meet him. So that's a positive of this season, is that it's leaning into the most intriguing thing that was introduced last season, which was this like line of historical Santas and where Scott fits into that. That's really cool, and I'm glad they're kind of exploring that, the mythology of Santa, of the character of Santa, that like it's not just Scott. There was a Santa before and there will be a Santa after. Like, I think that's really interesting and cool. But they're doing it again, like in a really goofy, silly, stupid way. And again, this is my own hang up because of the place that the Santa Claus, the first movie, holds in my heart, is I don't like the cartoony, goofy, silly, over the top, stupid that the movie series and TV show became when it got geared more toward like modern kid sensibilities. And I think that's what they're doing here, is they're trying to like really make this attractive to what children at the time each movie or TV show was made would want to see. So like, because in the 90s, when the first movie came out, we didn't have the internet. It was brand new. People didn't have the internet in their homes yet, really. And if you did, it was Prodigy. And it was like dial up. And there was like two landing pages and email, and that was it. So there was more of a sense of wonder and realism, because at that point we still lived in a more innocent, I want to say, world, where like we didn't have to go over the top with goofiness and silliness. I'm getting real deep, sorry. But then, you know, the next few movies, I'm trying to remember the years. I want to say it was 2001 or two. It was 2002 that the second one came out. That's a post 9/11 world. That was 8 years after the first movie. That's a significant time jump. So the sensibilities of like youth and innocence changed a lot between the first and second movie. So in order to like appeal to the escapism of younger people, it got goofier and sillier and dumber, I think. You know, like if you look at what kids' stuff now is versus the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, it's like, what the hell are kids watching now? Like Paw Patrol and Bluey and like that kind of stuff is very different than, I don't know, like Eureka's Castle or The Electric Factory and Sesame Street. You know what I mean? And even like, what, let's say maybe 10 years ago with like Yo Gabba Gabba and that kind of stuff, like kids' entertainment was trippy as fuck for a long time and still is in a lot of cases. And it's because of this, like, to get a kid's attention now, you have to be constantly moving. You have to be brightly colored and loud and over the top because they're used to consuming things on YouTube and apps and stuff where it's in like 60 to 180 second chunks. And I think that shows like this that maybe are very nostalgic for me but aren't made for me hurt my heart a little bit. But having said all of that, this season is better than the last season, and I'm going to keep watching it. And even if I hated it, I would keep watching it because I have to. So yeah, they're also just like repeating storylines. You know, like they've been, this like replacement for Santa thing has been a story for the second and third movies and the last season. Like in the second season, it was the toy robot Santa. The third season, it was Jack Frost. And last season, it was Cal Penn's character. So like, someone else becoming Santa is not interesting, but they're going to keep chipping away until I guess they find a new Santa, and then we'll get 50 more seasons of the show sans Tim Allen. Oh, God. Okay, it's already been 35 minutes. What else? I watched The Curse on Showtime, which is new, and it's Emma Stone's new show with Nathan Fielder, who did Nathan for You and The Rehearsal on HBO. And it's a scripted comedy that feels like an improv comedy, and it's like awkward humor that I don't understand or enjoy. And the whole first episode is about penis size, which is weird. Like, we just randomly watch Nathan Fielder pee. And it's clearly a prosthetic penis that he's peeing out of, but like, it just, the camera's just on his dick as he's peeing. And then it pans up to his head. So we see that it's him. And the next scene is Emma Stone's dad, his Nathan Fielder's character's wife, his dad is like peeing into his plants and shows his little tiny penis too. And it becomes a whole thing about like overcoming your tiny penis. It's so fucking weird. I don't understand it. It's about a couple who have a home flipping show on HGTV called Flipanthropy, where they move into Espanola, a community in New Mexico, and they like build passive energy houses, which like converts the sun's energy into like electricity and stuff. And they're like trying to build jobs within the community, but then there's like some shady past where Emma Stone's character's parents are like slum lords. And then I don't know, they like the show they're filming, they want to catch Nathan Fielder's character like doing charity, so he gives a $100 bill to a little girl who's selling cans of Sprite, and then once the cameras are down, he tries to take the money back, so then she curses him. And that's the maybe, I guess, the curse of the title of the show, unless they're talking about like, I don't know, like there's this phrase called the curse of the Irish, which is I'm so sorry that everything I've been talking about lately is dicks. Sorry. But the curse of the Irish is like a tongue-in-cheek way of talking about like the stereotype of Irishmen having small penises. So maybe it's also a reference to that. It's unclear how much dick size is going to play into the rest of the show. And it's going to remain unclear because I'm not watching it ever again. But if that's your zhuzh, that's on Showtime after Fellow Travelers on Sundays at 10 o'clock and new episodes on Paramount Plus on Fridays. Emma Stone was fun and she's getting really great reviews for it. I just don't fucking get what the show is. But if you like cringe comedy, this show is going to be your jam. It's not my jam at all. So yeah. And then other than that, I'm just watching like a whole bunch of Hallmark movies. So let's get into that then. All right. So as I predicted, this was a not great week for Hallmark Christmas movies. The Mistletoe Lane mystery was very mediocre and was not actually a mystery. It was like a scavenger hunt. There's a difference. The Friday night movie Everything Christmas is one of is this is how bad this season's movies are, is that it would probably be by far the worst movie in most years, but I have such a bad taste in my mouth from Design by Christmas or Christmas by Design, whichever the fuck one it is, about the Project Runway pajama collection for Christmas Eve and the Elf Capades. What the fuck? The Flipping for Christmas one from last weekend, where they flipped a house at Christmas and talked about gentrification, even though no one actually knew what gentrification was, because they were not gentrifying the town, they were just urbanizing it. There is a difference. That one pissed me off. And also the Christmas Sky one with Ryan Pavey about the woman with the selective blindness who decorates a fucking planetarium for Christmas. These are all such terrible movies that Everything Christmas might be the worst. It really might, because it's the absolute dumbest. It makes no sense and it's very, very, very poorly acted. So it might be the worst, but also I would watch it again before I'd watch some of his other ones. So like, I don't know. That was the Friday night movie. And then Saturday was Christmas Island, which was my recommendation and probably was the best of them. Although the jury obviously is still out on tonight's movie because it hasn't aired yet. But considering I don't even remember what tonight's movie is going to be, doesn't bode well. So, oh, it's the Heidelberg one. It's the one that's in Germany. Probably not Heidi Heidelberg. I just Yeah. Bad week. Just bad week. But let's talk about what's coming up this week. Okay. Thursday. Oh, God. The latest in the Come Home for Christmas series. So, for those of you who are not Hallmark initiated, maybe like 5 years ago, Hallmark teamed with Blake Shelton. Yes, that Blake Shelton, the country singer from The Voice, who's married to Gwen Stefani. And his mother had written a Christmas book called Time for You to Come Home for Christmas. And I don't know what it was about. But he also then wrote a song called Time for You to Come Home for Christmas. And it was a big hit, so Hallmark made a movie out of it. And that did so well that they brought Blake Shelton on to produce, like, this is the fifth or sixth. So it's, okay, so the first one was, what was the first one? Time for You to Come Home, Time for Me to Come Home, Time for Them to Come Home, Time for Us to Come Home, Time for Him to Come Home. This is the sixth. Time for Her to Come Home. So that this one is premiering on the Hallmark Movies Now app on Thursday, and then it'll be airing on Hallmark later. So I'm going to skip over that one, but it came up in my feed and I had to talk about how much I hate it. Okay. So airing this Thursday on Hallmark Movies and Mysteries, actually airing on Hallmark Movies and Mysteries, is A World Record Christmas. Charlie is an autistic boy determined to set a Guinness World Record by stacking 1,400 Jenga blocks. Okay, one, is that really a world record? Doesn't seem like that many Jenga blocks. And number two, the pandering. This is the Christmas with a blind guy. This is the Christmas with an autistic kid. This is Christmas with a colorblind person. This is Christmas with a widow. Like, it's just, this is all that Hallmark Movies and Mysteries is. But that stars Nikki DeLoach and a cute dad named Lucas Bryan. Don't know who he is, but he's adorbs. He looks good in a sweater. So that's a contender. On Friday is Navigating Christmas. This is on the Hallmark Channel. Recently divorced Melanie and her son Jason visit a remote island for Christmas, only to find themselves running a real working lighthouse where she connects with the curt but cute owner. And that is Chelsea Hobbs. Oh, I used to love her. She was on Make It or Break It, if you ever watched that on ABC Family about the gymnasts. I loved that show. And Steven Hazar. That one doesn't sound very good. Saturday, A Merry Scottish Christmas. When estranged siblings Lindsay and Brad Morgan travel to Scotland at Christmas to reunite with their mother, Jo, a big family secret is revealed. And that is Lacey Chabert and Scott Wolf as the siblings. Party of Five reunion, hello. That's for sure going to be my recommendation for the week, because even if it's bad, getting to see them together, who cares? And then Sunday, this one also sounds cute, is Holiday Hotline. After leaving London, Abby connects with an anonymous caller while working at a cooking hotline. The caller is single dad John, who Abby unknowingly has become smitten with in real life. And that is the woman looks familiar, but her name's not here. And it's also Niall Mader from When Calls the Heart and a bunch of these other Christmas movies. That sounds like a really fun throwback movie. Like, do cooking hotlines even exist anymore? Like, this used to be a thing, I think, back in like the 50s, where if you had an issue with a recipe, but then also if you just had general cooking questions, there was literally like a hotline you could call and a woman would be on the other end and she would answer your questions. Like, I don't know, I'm making mashed potatoes and they're too gluey. What do I do to make them less sticky? And she'd be like, well, you need to add some melted butter. And like that kind of thing. And I feel like this might have already been a movie. Like, it sounds like a remake. It sounds very You've Got Mail, Bells Are Ringing. Maybe that's why I'm thinking of it. It's a little like Bells Are Ringing. But it also has like the shop around the corner, parfumery, She Loves Me, You've Got Mail kind of feeling. So it's kind of like a mishmash of those, and that also sounds really stinking cute. So that has promise. But I mean, obviously the recommendation for the week is going to be the Saturday movie A Merry Scottish Christmas with Scott Wolf and Lacey Chabert. So get into it. It's the first Lacey Chabert movie of the year. She's done two, and her other one comes out next week during Thanksgiving week, and that's a sequel to last year's Haul Out the Holly. I think that's it. Yeah. This was a really entertaining 45 minutes for me personally. I don't even know if I made any sense, but hopefully I did. And hopefully y'all will keep listening. I'm approaching 100 episodes. So yay for me and for you if you've listened to all of them. But yeah, it's end of the year. It's Spotify Wrapped. So please share the podcast if you are so inclined. Don't forget to answer the polls and questions that are on Spotify if that's where you're listening. And yeah, keep downloading. Listenership has gone down quite a bit, but I'm still having fun, so I will keep doing this as long as I feel like it. I don't care about you. Okay, that's it for me. I'll be back next week with more recaps, more reviews, more analyses, and more recommendations. Have a great week, everyone.